Welcome to SCOTUS Cast. Fleeing from the police while in a vehicle and mandatory minimums edition. Thank you for tuning in. On June 9th, 2011, the Supreme Court announced its decision in Sykes v. United States. If an armed defendant has three prior violent felony convictions, the Armed Career Criminal Act, or ACCA, provides that that defendant, if convicted, would face a 15-year mandatory minimum prison term. The petitioner in this case contested whether his Class D Indiana felony of fleeing in a vehicle from a police officer counts as a violent felony for the purposes of this ACCA provision. In an opinion delivered by Justice Kennedy, the court held by a vote of 6-3 that the petitioner's Indiana vehicle flight conviction is a violent felony for the purposes of the ACCA. Chief Justice Roberts and Justices Breyer, Alito, and Sotomayor joined Justice Kennedy's opinion. Justice Thomas filed an opinion concurring in the judgment. Justice Scalia filed a dissenting opinion. Justice Kagan also filed a dissenting opinion, which Justice Ginsburg joined. To discuss the case, we have Brian J. Paul, who is a partner at Ice Miller LLP. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. And now, Mr. Paul.
What is a violent felony? In the abstract, that might seem like a fairly straightforward question to answer. Try to define that term against the backdrop of an open-ended, imprecise statute, however, and things become more complicated, far more complicated. The Armed Career Criminal Act, or ACCA, defines violent felony in relevant part as any crime punishable by imprisonment for a term exceeding 1 year that is burglary, arson, or extortion, involves use of explosives, or otherwise involves conduct that presents a serious potential risk of physical injury to another. As you might imagine, it is the last part of this definition, the so-called residual clause, that presents all the difficulty. How exactly should a court decide which crimes involve conduct that presents a serious potential risk of physical injury to another? A lot rides on the answer. For a felon convicted of possessing a firearm who has three prior violent felony convictions, faces a 15-year mandatory minimum sentence and the possibility of life imprisonment. Whereas without those prior convictions, he would face a far less severe sentence, one that could not exceed 10 years. The U.S. sentencing guidelines contain a functionally identical provision, Section 4B1.1, the career offender guideline, that if triggered, ups a defendant's criminal history category and total offense level, and thus his presumptive prison sentence. Over the course of three cases, James v. United States in 2007, Begay v. United States in 2008, in Chambers v. United States in 2009, the Supreme Court gave us the answer, or at least what many thought was the answer, setting forth essentially a three-step analytical process. In the first step, a court is to categorize the prohibited conduct by looking only at the statutory elements of the offense. The actual facts of the underlying conviction are, at least in theory, irrelevant. Then, in the second step, the court determines whether that crime, as generically defined and ordinarily committed, poses a serious potential risk of physical injury similar in degree to the risks posed by the enumerated crimes, burglary, arson, extortion, and crimes involving use of explosives. Finally, in the third step, the court decides whether the crime is similar in kind to the enumerated crimes, which, according to the Supreme Court in Begay, all typically involve purposeful, violent, and aggressive conduct. While easy to state, this test has proved anything but easy to apply. How does a court determine the level of risk posed by a particular crime as it is ordinarily committed? Is judicial intuition really sufficient, as the court has suggested, or does there need to be hard evidence? Also, does the crime have to be at least as risky as the riskiest enumerated crime, or does it just have to be risky as the least riskiest enumerated crime? What about the risk level posed by the crime's closest enumerated analog? Does it matter? What does the ordinary commission of a particular crime look like anyway? And if burglary of a dwelling passes as violent and aggressive, and it does, what other kinds of crimes pass as violent and aggressive? Unfortunately, with Sykes versus United States, the Supreme Court's fourth foray into this topic in as many years, the court has managed only to generate still more questions and very few, if any, answers. Indicted in federal court, Marcus Sykes pleaded guilty to illegal possession of a firearm. By then, Sykes was already a felon, but was he a career criminal? The government argued he was. Twice before, Sykes had used a firearm to commit robbery. He acknowledged those crimes for violent felonies. His third prior felony was another matter, however. It involved vehicular flight in violation of Indiana's resisting law enforcement statute. Under Part A of this statute, anyone who flees from a law enforcement officer by vehicle after the officer has, by visible or audible means, identified himself and ordered the person to stop, commits a felony. This particular form of felony flight, the type of vehicular flight for which Sykes was convicted, requires no proof that the defendant inflicted bodily injury on anyone in the course of the flight, or even that the defendant posed a substantial risk of bodily injury to someone. Those factors are specifically covered by Part B of the statute. It is a separate offense altogether if the defendant, while committing vehicular flight, inflicted bodily injury on another person, or operated the vehicle in a manner that created a substantial risk of bodily injury to another person. The difference between Part A of the statute and Part B of the statute, then, is the difference between ordinary or simple vehicular flight and aggravated vehicular flight, a distinction that is recognized in some form or fashion in 45 different states. Five circuits, including the Seventh, which is the circuit that decided the Sykes case, had concluded that a conviction for ordinary vehicular flight is a violent felony. Three other circuits had concluded otherwise. In a 5-3 decision, the Supreme Court sided with the Seventh Circuit and affirmed Sykes' 188-month sentence as an armed career criminal. When a perpetrator defies a law enforcement command by fleeing in a car, wrote Justice Kennedy for an unlikely majority that included Chief Justice Roberts as well as Justices Breyer, Alito, and Sotomayor, the determination to elude capture makes a lack of concern for the safety of property and persons of pedestrians and other drivers an inherent part of the offense. Even if the criminal attempting to elude capture drives without going at full speed or going the wrong way, he creates the possibility that the police will, in a legitimate and lawful manner, exceed or almost match his speed or use force to bring him within their custody. A perpetrator's indifference to these collateral consequences has violent, even lethal, potential for others. It places property and persons at serious risk of injury. Flight from a law enforcement officer invites, even demands, pursuit. As that pursuit continues, the risk of an accident accumulates. And having chosen to flee and thereby commit a crime, the perpetrator has all the more reason to seek to avoid capture. So said Justice Kennedy. Sounds reasonable enough. But is this conclusion consistent with the statutory elements of ordinary vehicular flight under Indiana law? Arguably not. Ordinary vehicular flight does not, by definition, place people at serious risk of injury. It is irrelevant that Sykes may have put people at risk of injury in the course of his flight from police, which the record showed he did, something the majority was only too eager to point out. The important point is that he was convicted of ordinary, not aggravated vehicular flight. An ordinary vehicular flight does not, as defined by the controlling statute, present a serious risk of injury. The court, however, did not think it mattered that Indiana defined ordinary vehicular flight separately from aggravated vehicular flight, that is, from the type of flight that does present a serious risk of injury. Both are treated as crimes of the same magnitude in Indiana, Class D felonies. And so the court thought both are rough approximations for the same basic offense. But what about the actual risks posed by ordinary vehicular flight? What allowed the majority to conclude that ordinary vehicular flight poses risks that are roughly similar in degree to the risks posed by, say, arson or burglary? Judging from the record before the court, it's not clear that there was anything that allowed the majority to form this conclusion, other than, that is, facts and data that most lawyers would have thought to be off limits. As Justice Scalia noted in his dissent, the government presented almost no statistics in the courts below. It was only once the case got to the Supreme Court that the government decided to present much of its data, data on which the Supreme Court relied heavily. According to the statistics cited by the court, between 4 and 17% of all chases end in injury. None of this data had been subject to adversarial testing at the trial court level, however. None of the people who conducted the studies, for instance, testified at trial as expert witnesses. Not even the Supreme Court scrutinized the methodologies behind the studies. It never looked at, for example, whether the data was a representative sample of vehicular flights, or whether the data was skewed toward the rarer, riskier forms of flight. The court simply accepted the study's findings on faith, which, Justice Scalia suggested, was not only unfair to the defendant, but given that most of these statistics had not made an appearance in the record below, amounted to untested judicial fact-finding masquerading as statutory interpretation. Well, what about the third step in the analysis, then? Even if we assume ordinary vehicular flight poses a similar degree of risk as the enumerated crimes, is it sufficiently violent and aggressive to be similar in kind to the enumerated crimes? There's a fair argument it is not. As the 11th Circuit had put it before Sykes was decided, one who fails to stop on police command without more is not cut from the same cloth as burglars, arsonists, extortionists, or those who criminally detonate explosives. The crime of ordinary vehicular flight, the court said, seems more appropriately characterized as the crime of a fleeing coward, not an armed career criminal bent on inflicting physical injury. Instead of just addressing this argument on its merits, however, the court decided instead to dispel the notion that every violent felony must pass the purposeful, violent, and aggressive test, calling this step in the analysis the product of an overreading of the court's prior opinions. The court thought that the purposeful, violent, and aggressive test would in many cases be redundant with the inquiry into risk, but not always, the court suggested. When exactly that test might still be useful after Sykes, though, is an open question. Justice Scalia, in his dissent, understood the majority to relegate the test to strict liability, negligence, and recklessness crimes. Justice Kagan, on the other hand, in a separate dissent, which Justice Ginsburg joined, predicted the resurgence of the test the next time the court considered a crime that involved a risk of injury, but not aggression or violence. All three justices agreed, however, that the court's partial retreat from the purposeful, violent, and aggressive test only served to further muddy the ACCA's residual clause, a proposition with which Justice Thomas, who wrote a separate concurrence, also agreed. Justices Kagan and Ginsburg noted that they would have taken the difference in definitions between ordinary and aggravated flight more seriously. As their dissent pointed out, the court does not proceed by exploring whether some platonic form of an offense satisfies the ACCA's residual clause. The court instead focuses on the elements of the actual state statute at issue. Doing so respects a state's choice to divide the full spectrum of vehicular flight into different degrees based on the danger associated with the driver's conduct. On the one end of the spectrum are flights that result in death. On the other are mere failures to stop. To count both as violent felonies is to pay insufficient heed to the way the Indiana legislature drafted its statutes as a series of escalating offenses, ranging from the simple to the most aggravated. It did not matter to Justices Kagan and Ginsburg that ordinary vehicular flight and aggravated vehicular flight were both Class D felonies under Indiana law. Not only does Indiana sentencing law enable judges to account for the difference between crimes of the same general type, even if it didn't, the fact is that similar punishment does not necessarily imply similar risk. Indiana classifies other crimes as Class D felonies that look nothing like violent felonies, election fraud and computer tampering, to name just two, yet no one would claim these crimes are similar in degree or kind to vehicular flight. Agree or disagree with this logic, though, it may well not matter in future cases. since other states not only separately prohibit, but also, unlike Indiana, differently punish ordinary and aggravated vehicular flight. Describing the majority's opinion as tutti-frutti, Justice Scalia would have gone a different direction altogether and declared the statute void for vagueness. He thought the shoddy draftsmanship of the statute permits, indeed invites, arbitrary enforcement. We will be doing ad hoc application of ACCA to the vast variety of state criminal offenses until the cows come home, which will keep defendants and judges guessing for years to come, he declared. This, in turn, only serves to encourage further imprecision by Congress. Why make criminal statutes specific when it is easier to get fellow congressmen to vote for airy, tough-on-crime generalities that the Supreme Court will be all too happy to puzzle over? Garbage in, garbage out might be the lesson of this case. We all can hopefully agree that the court has tried to grapple with the ACCA's residual clause earnestly and in good faith, and yet still agree that the result of that effort has amounted to something less than a coherent body of law that provides a clear, workable standard. Fault lies not so much with the court, but with Congress. Congress has either by design or for reasons of political expediency or out of sheer neglect failed to provide the court with a definition of violent felony that would lead to predictable results. Criminal defendants typically pay the price for such imprecision, but so also does the reputation of the Supreme Court. It is all too easy to accuse a court of results-oriented jurisprudence when the statute it has interpreted is vague enough to allow for whatever result happens to be preferred by five justices. Politicians are fond of chastising judges for judicial activism, and as well they should. But maybe more judges would do well to follow Justice Scalia's lead and chastise Congress for creating the conditions that make the perception of judicial activism possible.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUS Cast. For more episodes of SCOTUS Cast, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at www.federalistsociety.org/multimedia.